and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Narcissism is a label that's been applied repeatedly to Donald Trump, but not just to Trump, also to Hillary Clinton, and no doubt many other past and present political figures and candidates. There's a kind of common sense notion of narcissism, which is perhaps why the term gets thrown around so much, but today we seek a deeper understanding of narcissism, one that therapists and psychoanalysts rely on and deploy when diagnosing and treating their clients. Michael Donner wears many hats. He is a psychoanalyst based in Oakland and also a clinical and forensic psychologist. He is president of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis and a member of its faculty. Michael has also been on the faculty at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, St. Mary's College of California, Access Institute in San Francisco, and CSPP Alliant International University. When I sat down with Michael Donner in studio, I began by asking him to recount the myth of Echo and Narcissus, which appears in the Roman poet Ovid's work, The Metamorphoses.
There's different versions of the story that I've run across, but essentially the story goes something like this. There's a wood nymph named Echo and Narcissus, and Narcissus is described usually as a very beautiful young man or boy. And as often happens in Greek tales, people get mad, the gods get mad, and Echo did something to make someone mad and was condemned to only be able to repeat. So she's wandering through the woods, and she sees Narcissus and thinks he's really beautiful, but she can't speak to him. She falls in love with Narcissus. Narcissus is wandering through the woods, and he hears her behind him and says, "Who's there?" And she repeats back, "Who's there?" And eventually they encounter each other, and she rushes towards him to kiss him, and he pushes her away, another activity that then made one of the gods mad. And so Narcissus was then cursed and condemned to fall in love with the first person that he sees. So he's wandering through the forest. He happens upon a lake, gazes into the lake, sees his own reflection, and immediately falls in love. He leans forward to kiss the object of his love. The image goes away. He pulls back. He tries to kiss again. The image goes away. And eventually, because he can't tear himself away from the love of his life, his own image, he eventually starves and dies. So that's, and I guess as the story goes, that is the source of the Narcissus flower as he withers away. And at the spot upon which he died, the Narcissus flower blooms.
And is that kind of the origin of the word narcissism and narcissistic and this idea, this association of those terms with excessive love for oneself?
Well, not just excessive love for oneself, but the danger of loving only oneself, the dangers in not having a relationship with another person. But yes, that's where it began.
So his obsession with himself was clearly unhealthy. Does that mean that all forms of narcissism are unhealthy?
Well, I want to go back to the word obsession for just a second, because I'm not sure that we would call it an obsession. It was his capacity to only love himself. It was a limitation rather than an obsession. But
gotcha.
So the word narcissism has taken on a lot of meanings. It gets used in lots of ways. It gets used to describe political figures. It gets used to define generations. So there's narcissism, which is a kind of a concept that emerged from Freud and other psychologically oriented people throughout the years as an idea that reflects a sense that we have about ourselves. And then there's the more pejorative word narcissist, which is used to describe a person with an excess of narcissism. And that excess is sort of pathological narcissism as compared to healthy narcissism. So there's a spectrum and a continuum between healthy and pathological narcissism.
So what would you consider kind of the threshold over which one passes to pathological narcissism? You know, at what point does narcissism become pathological?
Well, this is a sort of more my personal definition rather than a professional definition, but I think it's when the sense of oneself and the value that one places on one's own needs begins to occur at the expense of others in a way that's harmful to others, possibly when other choices are actually available. So someone who has a good, healthy sense of self-regard and takes care of themselves, that's narcissism being manifested. But when you do that at the expense of others, and maybe even at your own expense, I think that's where it starts to sort of, if we think of that as a continuum in the midline, that's where it starts to cross over into more pathological forms of narcissism or unhealthy narcissism.
And when you say at the expense of oneself, or partly at the expense of oneself, what are you referring to? Are there certain ways in which other people can harm you, or are there certain ways in which you are vulnerable in particular ways because of pathological narcissism? And of course, we're talking about, you know, this category of people.
Yeah, I think the word vulnerability makes a lot of sense there and is a useful way to think about it. So if your need for to feel right might come at the expense of a relationship, so you might lose a relationship, you might lose a job, the inability to say, gee, I made a mistake, I should do something in a different direction. When that becomes cumulative, I think people all do that at various times, but when it's cumulative and a style that pervades the way you function in the world, it can have quite dramatic consequences. The metaphor, of course, is Narcissus unable to tear himself away from his own image, can't drink and get what he needs from either the lake where he needs water or from another person, so he dies alone. And I think that's the image that I have of unhealthy narcissism.
So if I'm right, a narcissistic, in the sense of unhealthy person, develops narcissism in his or her childhood. So let's talk about childhood, and let's start with really early childhood, kind of newborn, infant, toddler. At this stage of life, there's no doubt a great deal of dependence, right, on the parent, on the mother. Can you talk about the psychological dynamics at play?
Sure. The model of development that makes the most sense for me is one in which the baby is born completely dependent, but at the same time without really a sense of a relationship with another person. So the baby doesn't know that he or she is dependent. The baby just sort of exists in the world. And babies, when they're hungry, they cry. When they're tired, they cry. When, you know, they need to have their diaper changed, they cry or fuss. And magically something appears and takes, for the most part, and ideally, somebody appears, but to the baby it's a thing. And in psychoanalytic terms, it's often referred to as an object. That's how psychoanalysts will characterize who these other people are in the world that are taking care of the baby. So that can be a mother, it can be a father, it can be a caregiver. But these objects appear and meet the need of the baby, and there's a kind of a magical component to it. And so it takes a fair amount of time developmentally before the baby starts to actually recognize that, and actually when this happens, the baby's not a baby anymore, to recognize that there's actually another person in the world who's providing something that the then child actually needs and wants, that it isn't the baby who's magically and omnipotently causing food, sustenance, comfort, nurturing to appear.
And at what age does that normally happen, and when does the baby, or not the baby anymore, get a sense of agency, a sense of me and of I and of mine?
You know, it develops kind of over a long period of time. It's not a switch that turns on. It's a kind of a gradual increasing awareness of the other. It starts to happen, I guess. I should have these numbers more firmly in my mind, but I think somewhere around the point at which a baby starts to put something in its own mouth to soothe itself. So maybe between 3 to 6 months, the baby starts first to develop a sense that it can soothe itself, that there's something out there that, you know, hasn't come yet. It's not quite clear what that is. Over time, the relationship that the baby has with the mother-father caregiver starts to develop and become more sophisticated. The baby starts to recognize the other. So I think probably around a year or so, you start to hear caregivers say, you know, you just have to hold on, I'll be right there, hang on. And that's the stage at which you will see a baby kind of recognize that there's another person who maybe has some needs for themselves and is increasingly taking care of their needs. And that develops and grows for quite some time, actually. You'll see a certain kind of omnipotence that remains for a very long time. Children often feel very hurt when their parents don't give them the gift that they want, or they don't know what they need when they need it. And this can extend well into childhood, but, you know, much less prominently than in the very early stages of sort of between 0 and 3, I think, are the sort of the key periods where you see narcissism most prominently as a developmental feature.
Michael Donner joins me in studio. He is a psychoanalyst and a clinical and forensic psychologist based in Oakland, and he is president of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis and a member of that center's faculty. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So there is a kind of, as you're saying, a narcissistic phase of development that begins. And I guess we kind of know that because at some point, children do seem to be completely preoccupied with themselves, right? That they're the center of the world, and everybody else is playing an auxiliary role in the unfolding adventure.
That's right. And it's a kind of a two-way street, too, because for a baby to survive, they actually have to be the center of the caregiver's world. Freud referred to this period of time as His Majesty the Baby, you know, the way in which the baby is the real focus of a lot of the people and adults in the environment, and has to survive.
So there's obviously an attachment form between the infant and the parent, and then there is a separation at some point, right? Or this is a gradual process as well, no doubt. What are the dynamics involved in that process of separating or understanding a separation between yourself and the parent?
Well, there's lots of ways that this process can go. And, you know, there's the sort of ideal, or maybe what we might think of as healthy or normal development is a process in which the baby has a need. It's not a need that needs to be fulfilled right away. The caregivers are sufficiently meeting the child's need that the child doesn't become too distressed or too anxious, but can develop a kind of an internal capacity to self-soothe. So this is thumb-sucking, teddy bears, those kinds of things. Or we refer to them as transitional objects, you know, like as we refer to the caregiver as an object, the teddy bear fulfills that sort of soothing function. So as the caregiver and the child sort of work together, they're navigating how much can the child tolerate frustration, how much can the child tolerate gratification. Freud also said somewhere that optimal parenting is to allow for optimal frustration and optimal gratification. So you can put that down somewhere if you can figure out what optimal is. So that's the kind of normal developmental path. The child is neither too gratified, because you get the sort of spoiled child who continues to have that sense that they magically make things appear. If they scream, cry, complain, they're fed, changed, nurtured, and so on. You want a child to feel safe and secure, but also that they can manage their own needs as they move forward and can tolerate a certain amount of frustration of their wishes and impulses.
So what on the parenting side of this relationship, what happens or what tends to happen such that the child does not develop in a normal, healthy way in the sense of a narcissistic attitude or attribute? What kinds of parenting can bring about an unhealthy, I guess it might be, balance such that narcissism rears its ugly head in kind of an unproductive way?
Well, first, I want to offer a caveat here that there's a lot of forgiveness in parenting. Donald Winnicott was a British psychoanalyst and a pediatrician before he became a psychoanalyst, and he coined the term the good enough mother. And what he was describing was that, you know, no parent, no caregiver needs to do this perfectly, but that if overall caretaking is good enough, the child will be fine. We don't know how to create the perfect child or the perfect parent. But there's sort of two pathways that I think we see where development goes a little bit awry. The first is the one that's sort of been more popularized lately as people are complaining about millennials, and that's the kind of overindulgent parent, the parent who's, you know, from the very beginning of life or maybe even in utero is trying to create the perfect environment for their child. So they may be excessively worried about the environment of birth. They may be really focused on the proper bedding and pajamas and things like that, as if these things will ultimately make a difference in the child's life. And there's a sort of hyper-focus on creating the sort of perfect environment for the child. Now, that may seem like a really good idea. It's kind of manifests itself in, you know, the what's sometimes referred to as the self-esteem movement. Every child is a winner. Every child gets a trophy. While on the one hand, this might make the child feel good at the time, someone said, and I can't remember exactly who said this, that the child might actually start to figure out that the parent doth protest too much. If you're constantly telling me I'm the very best, maybe you're a little bit worried that I'm not the very best. Kids are kind of savvy and they pick up on these things. But the kind of popular conception of the so-called millennial as self-indulged and, you know, not able to function as effectively as the previous generation thinks it did, is that they expect things to come to them. They don't have to work too hard to get things. They're too demanding. They're too entitled. And that's the pathway of the parent who doesn't provide enough frustration for the child. So every need is gratified, and the thinking is that then you raise a child with, and I'm putting air quotes around this, too much self-esteem. They feel too good about themselves, and so they don't have the capacity to tolerate a work environment or a relationship where things are difficult or challenging.
And I want to ask you about the second pathway, but this idea that children, or some children, given this sort of parenting regime, they internalize the belief that they're special people, maybe more special than others, and are entitled to certain privileges. How does that square perhaps with a child's understanding that, hey, I'm not as wonderful and as valuable as my parents are making it out to be, right? They're treating me like I'm, you know, elevated to some extraordinary degree, and I know actually in my heart that I'm not such a person, that I'm pretty ordinary.
Well, there's a fundamental basis of psychoanalysis that we are not a unitary mind, that we have sort of multiple kind of lines of psychological development taking place simultaneously, and that contradictory ideas coexist in our minds. So on the one hand, you can have a sense of being entitled, that you expect everything to come to you as you want it. On the other hand, you may actually be left with a good deal of anxiety, the sort of, what if I'm not really as good as they say? What if what I really want doesn't come to me? And so if, in fact, that's a developmental pathway that takes hold, what you might see in somebody who has this anxiety about not getting what they want when they want it, it can look really entitled and they can look really demanding, but you may see a lot of nervousness behind it. These might be children in school or students in school who can't tolerate getting less than an A and will be really crushed by a bad grade because they expect something good to happen. And when it doesn't, it can be very distressing to them.
Okay, so we've talked about kind of one pathway, which involves parents being, as you said, hyper-focused on creating the perfect environment for their child as he or she grows up. What's the second pathway that you see that might create a narcissistic child and adult?
The second pathway is the parent who doesn't create a sense of safety. It's the opposite of the parent who doesn't provide enough frustration. It's the parent who somehow is too frustrating. So the child doesn't develop the capacity to relate to the other person that other people are not seen as the source of comfort, safety, and security. So I think what happens as a result of that is the child then learns to rely solely on themselves. Other people's input, ideas aren't valued or even expected. So other people are in a certain way an extension of the child. They don't really exist. They're more a source of frustration. So that kind of a child develops into an adult or an adolescent or an adult who can't tolerate getting their needs not met and wind up feeling angry and frustrated. Now, both of these pathways can develop somebody who looks different. Sometimes these people look very inhibited. Sometimes they look very grandiose, arrogant, and entitled. There can be overlap. But I think when you don't develop the capacity to really see that the other people in the world have needs, wants, and desires that are separate from yours, you start to look like what we call a narcissistic personality.
And that's really key, as you were saying earlier, right? That they don't they don't have maybe the proper perspective on other people and what they need and desire. The focus is more on themselves, excessively on themselves.
Well, yes, but there's a metaphor that I'm fond of in trying to describe this. This was told to me by a supervisor of mine. He said, you know, with this kind of a person, they experience other people in the world sort of the way we experience our body parts. We expect our arm to be able to move when we want to move it. We don't really give it much thought. If we grab for something, we expect to be able to reach it. If something happens and for some reason, you know, we try to grab a cup or a pen or something and our arm doesn't move or it flails about, we will become angry or frustrated or depressed or worried because we expect it to work in a particular way. So it's really a sense that other people are an extension of us. They are there to meet our needs. And when they don't, so remember, this is sort of the mind of the child is carried into the adult. When another person we think of as another person doesn't meet our needs, somebody with a sort of too much narcissism is going to experience something not working quite right. Or my own personal metaphor is you trip over a crack in the sidewalk and you turn around and you glare at the sidewalk because the sidewalk's not supposed to get in your way. There's that feeling that things don't exist outside of how we want to experience them.
Michael Donner joins us in our KPFA studios. He is a psychoanalyst. He is president of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. He teaches and consults on law and ethics for clinicians in California and across the country. And he's been on the faculty at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, St. Mary's College of California, Access Institute in San Francisco, and CSPP Alliant International University. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You may have begun to already answer this, but I read in something you wrote about two types or forms of narcissism, overt and covert. Let's start with overt. What are the characteristics of this type?
I think I've sort of described this without using that word, but the overt narcissist is someone who I think is the classic image of the narcissist, grandiose, arrogant, unconcerned of others. They may appear as if they think they're the greatest, the smartest, whether or not that's actually consistent. And even if it's true, they impose that on others and expect others to see them as they view themselves.
And by consistent, you mean consistent with their own self-perception?
That's right.
And what about the covert type?
Well, the covert type could come across as inhibited and insecure. I think the covert type is maybe best exemplified by the anxious adolescent who walks around school with a new pimple and imagines that everybody is looking at them and they're ashamed. So there's a sense that the world is actually focused on the covert narcissist, but they don't necessarily feel grandiose or entitled, or in a way you could say they feel special because everybody's looking at them, but it's very painful.
So might the covert type of narcissist be more likely to emerge from that second pathway where the parenting is kind of distant and they don't provide the child with a feeling of being safe and secure?
I actually go back and forth on the developmental pathway and whether one leads to the other, in part because I'm not sure that parents just parent in one way. I can imagine some parents would combine the two. They might overindulge in some areas and be frustrating and really difficult in others. So I don't know that the research is clear enough to lay out whether one kind of parenting produces one kind of of personality style or not, I think that we may see combinations in people.
And, you know, if I'm grandiose and I'm have an excessive amount of self-esteem, and so, you know, I think I'm great, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm that concerned with how other people view me. And I'm wondering how much that factor plays into narcissism, pathological narcissism.
You know, the question really that I have about people who appear grandiose and unconcerned about others is that you actually also see a great deal of fragility. I think of them sometimes as hyperinflated balloons. They're easily deflated. So they may appear on the one hand as if they don't care about anyone else in terms of caring about, you know, the other person's thoughts, feelings, and ideas, and caring about them as a human being. They may lack a certain kind of compassion. But if the reflection that they need to see is not there, they may be very easily wounded and deflate very quickly. In professional practice, what you sometimes see are very, very successful executives. They've thrived professionally. They've had, you know, marriages, children, expensive homes and cars. And they get to a certain point and something can happen in their lives. For example, the children grow up and they're older and the spouse feels like he or she can move on. And the grandiose, all-powerful person collapses. They become profoundly depressed. That's often when I see these kinds of seemingly successful, sometimes often men in therapy, is after they've had some big failure or a career shift that didn't work or a promotion that they didn't get, because they may have been alienating people along the way, and then they collapse. They're just deflated. And they then look sad, depressed, scared, and anxious.
And this suggests, Michael, that maybe their self-esteem isn't really that strong and at such a high level after all, if they're so vulnerable to slights. I mean, it suggests that they're not really satisfied with the person they are, despite the way they try and come off or the way they come off.
Yeah, well, you've used self-esteem here as if it's synonymous with narcissism. And, you know, it's tricky because I think when we talk about somebody with a good self-esteem or healthy self-esteem, we're talking about a healthy dose of narcissism. But I think somebody who's narcissistic does not have high self-esteem. What they have is a sense of themselves that is not realistic. They think they're great. They want other people to think they're great. They say they're great. They may say they're the greatest. But if something happens, they can be very, very hurt and wounded. And somebody with good self-esteem generally does not have that particular kind of response. In our political climate right now, I think we can sort of see, for example, I think of President Obama as somebody with a good, healthy dose of narcissism and somebody with a good, strong sense of self-esteem. You have to have a lot of narcissism to think that you can be the president of the United States and beat everybody else who wants to be the president and, you know, lead the country. But I also think that he's a person who has been attacked virulently and yet has persevered, doesn't seem to have been particularly affected as far as I can see, doesn't seem to retaliate. So to me, those are the qualities that a person has who has both a lot of healthy narcissism and good self-esteem. We might think of somebody else who has the same ambition, wants to be president of the United States, thinks that they're good at it, thinks that they've done well enough in their life that they deserve it, but when criticized or attacked or made fun of, they get really angry, they can't tolerate the insults, and they retaliate or react in a way that makes it look like they were actually quite wounded by the things that they've heard.
I can't talk you, by the way, into a diagnosis of any presidential candidate, can I? Because that would not be professional, right? That's not something you can do and maintain yourself as a professional psychoanalyst.
Yeah, that's right. As I'm sure most people have heard by now, we're not allowed to diagnose somebody that we haven't evaluated. And President Obama is not a patient of mine, although I am an admirer of him. And of course, I would never want to diagnose any other candidate for office.
Michael Donner joins us. He is a psychoanalyst and president of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. We'll take a short musical break, and then we'll speak more with Michael Donner about narcissism and its characteristics. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Donner joins me in studio. He is a psychoanalyst. He is a clinical and forensic psychologist, and he is president of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. He teaches and consults on law and ethics for clinicians in California and across the country. You know, one thing we haven't talked about, but maybe we have in a sense, is the controlling parent. You know, the parent who has to control every aspect of the child's environment. Does that weigh either way in terms of maybe leading a parent and a child down that pathway toward narcissism?
Well, sure. And I guess the thing I want to say is that parents are many times, and in some ways, we want them to be narcissistically involved in their child. We want them to imagine that their child can grow up to be the president of the United States. And so, you know, we all carry narcissism within us from our own childhood experiences, and we bring that to bear as parents. It's really, you know, it's the thing that makes us think we can be parents, that we can be good parents. And so we want that. It's only when, for the parent, the child also becomes an extension of the parent's needs. So the same kind of relationship that I was describing earlier, where the parent wants the child to be a particular way, something that can result in the child not developing a strong enough sense of their own identity outside of what others expect of them, that can actually also lead to a kind of a narcissistic pathway.
So an overly narcissistic parent might be one who has certain aspirations and dreams for their child, might think them great, might think them perfect for a while. But is it more likely the case that, you know, they're doing this for themselves, that the focus is on what can this child give to me, or how can this child reflect on me, as opposed to how can I help my child?
Yes, and when that happens and the child deviates from that pathway, as all children are going to do, this can result in any number of things. The parent can get very angry, the parent can get very withholding, and gradually what the child learns is that they have to become what this kind of caregiving other wants them to become. A psychoanalyst named Alice Miller wrote a book called The Drama of the Gifted Child. And the gift that she was talking about here, I think she maybe was being a bit ironic with the term gifted, but the gift she was talking about was the capacity to read other people. So a child who's growing up in the way that you described is going to be very, very sensitively attuned to the emotional needs of others. Now, that as they develop into adulthood, that can work both ways. Of course, they are still thinking about how they get their needs met. They're not really thinking about what the other person wants from them. It's actually more, what do I need to be, do, or say to get my needs met? So they can actually be quite successful, quite manipulative, because they're really reading the other person, but they do so in a way that's intended to have their own needs met, not to have a mutually affirming relationship with another person.
And that might be a condition other than pathological narcissism.
Well, at a certain point, if I'm trying to not treat narcissism as a diagnosis and a disease, although it is in our kind of diagnostic manual, but a kind of a way of relating in the world. So I think if you really don't see the other people in your lives as having needs, and where there's a kind of a back and forth and a mutuality in the relationship, then that is narcissism. And that person, the person who sort of sees other people as a way of getting their own needs met, is going to struggle in their life. They may be successful in some areas, but they're also going to struggle in their lives because eventually the other person figures it out. There's a number of books out as I read about narcissism and, you know, Google it. What I see is a number of books about what to do if you're married to a narcissist or what to do if your mother was a narcissist and, you know, sort of trying to help people see how difficult those relationships really can be. And if you're not having a satisfying relationship and the person that you're in a relationship is only seeing you as an extension of themselves, this is not going to be a happy relationship.
So you've given expert testimony in child custody cases, and in some of these cases, you're dealing with a divorce that was particularly tumultuous, and there's a lot of hostility coming from both sides. And, you know, and then there's this child right in the middle of this, and, you know, one side maybe has custody or there's joint custody, but the parents are fighting it out, and often over apparently insignificant details. And you've noted that, you know, there's been a lot of investigation into the psychological consequences of a divorce on the child, but not so much on the psychological condition of parents who are fighting over the details of custody, for example. So if we bring in narcissism to the picture, what have you observed about the role that narcissism plays in these kinds of parents, and these aren't, you know, the common kinds of parents one might come across in divorce proceedings, but in these kinds of parents?
Well, let's see. So, yes, I think actually what you said I want to underscore is that most people who get divorced are just getting a divorce. In fact, despite what we might see in the movies and on TV, the vast majority of people who get divorced separate, and you never see them in a custody evaluator's office or in the courtroom particularly. But there's a small percentage that have really intractable and ongoing high-conflict divorces. So one element, even of that group, there are lots of reasons that parents will have these highly conflicted divorces. But if a parent sees their child as an extension of them, then being separated and maybe losing to the other parent in a custody dispute would have really quite devastating consequences. I wrote a paper probably a decade old at this point called Tearing Children Apart. It was a kind of a take on the old Solomon tale of two women who were disputing whose baby it was. And King Solomon said, you know, well, that he would just cut the baby in half. And that story is told as the wisdom of Solomon, who figured that a real mother wouldn't let her baby get cut in half. So in that story, the mother said, no, don't cut the baby in half, give it to this other woman. Solomon knew that she was the real mother. But I think sometimes in these custody disputes that I get engaged in, what I see are parents who really are willing to cut the baby in half. They're so focused on getting what they want that it happens sometimes, if not often, at the expense of the well-being of the child or children that are involved.
And what's going on in the mind of a narcissistic parent, and let's say there's pathological narcissism involved here, who either loses custody of a child or has to share custody of a child after a divorce? I mean, if there is rage and anger and frustration there, what's behind that?
Well, I think it's driven in large part by the feeling of having lost control of something, that sense that I described earlier, that if you can't move your arm, you get angry, frustrated, or depressed. Something's not working the way that it's supposed to. And if you have a sense that your child is an extension of you and you can't have what you want when you want it, then you're going to feel angry, frustrated, or depressed. You may feel all of those at the same time. In the family law world, as a child custody evaluator, our task is to try to come up with something that's in the best interest of the child. That's the kind of legal requirement. And what happens sometimes with these parents is that they're not really thinking about what's best for the child. They're trying to do what's best for them.
And so what kinds of things might they argue over to the death with the other spouse, the ex-spouse, the separated spouse?
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of disagreements, but most often they are about time, how much time each parent is going to spend with the child. And so, we see parents who are going to fight for perfect 50-50 custody or who may go back to court to try to get another evening a week with the child. So they want 60% time with the child. Now, I think sometimes these parents in their own minds are doing what they tell themselves that they're the better parent for the child, but they aren't actually thinking about how much time does the child need to spend with the other parent. They're mostly thinking about how much time they think that child needs to spend with them.
And does this mean that, there's a conscious intention to harm the child?
I think that's very, very rare and only in the most severe circumstances. The paper I wrote was sparked by my having seen a number of articles in the newspaper about parents who killed their children rather than let them go with another parent. But that's very rare in my experience. For the most part, they aren't thinking about it that way. They have convinced themselves that what they think is best for the child is in fact best for the child, that their view of the world is the only view of the world. So if they think the other parent is not a good parent, then that's just the way that it is.
So Michael, and my guest again is Michael Donner. He's a clinical and forensic psychologist. He's a psychoanalyst based in Oakland, president of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. You referred earlier to healthy narcissism. And I wonder if you could talk about maybe someone who doesn't have that healthy narcissism, right? I mean, doesn't have pathological narcissism. In other words, lacks a kind of narcissism that would actually help them navigate the world. Is that possible?
I think that's the person that we would look at and think that person has low self-esteem. Not just self-effacing or humble, but they don't think much of themselves. They don't think much of their skills. When they do something that doesn't work out well, they get mad at themselves. They call themselves name. I can't believe I did that. I was so stupid. They might be just hesitant and unwilling to take chances. So they take the easy path, the one where that's less likely to result in failure, because failure would be intolerable, not in the way that the really deflated, grandiose person or the grandiose person who gets deflated might feel, but they just never really take chances, never put themselves out. I don't know if I really know the source of this quote, but a line that always goes through my mind is they lived lives of quiet desperation. These are people who've settled in their life because they're afraid to take a chance that might expose them to failure.
And, what's the best argument to make toward this person that, look, a kind of healthy narcissism would be good and maybe it would be important for you to work toward it?
Well, psychoanalysts don't think you can talk people into things. That's the sort of fundamental basis of our work and what differentiates psychoanalysts from cognitive behavioral therapists. Cognitive behavioral therapists think there are pathways and instructions and so on. And they might be right for some people. Self-help books, brief therapeutic interventions can be useful for some. But I think that when we're talking about a fundamental structure of personality, that's a hard thing to change. And it has to happen, in my opinion, in a relationship with another person, in a relationship that is a deep and trusting one. So, image of psychoanalysis is taking a really long time and you see somebody a lot of times a week, it's actually true, because I think that that's what it takes to establish enough of a degree of trust to really be vulnerable and to expose yourself to someone. It's not reparenting, really, because you can't do that, but it creates a condition that allows for the deepest fears and experiences that a person has to be revealed to their analyst or therapist who's trying to understand them and help them to grow and change.
And would you make the same argument and the same prescription in relation to somebody who has pathological narcissism, that kind of relationship that you're describing would be an important precondition to them moving beyond that condition?
Absolutely. And those people typically come into therapy, as I mentioned earlier, having had a collapse. Something has gone really wrong in their life, and they just can't understand it. So there's a moment of vulnerability when they have a sense that maybe there's somebody out there that can help them. Now, in my practice, I have to say often it comes, particularly with very successful men who've had a divorce or some kind of a business failure, somebody said, you either go to therapy or I'm leaving you, or you either go to therapy or you're fired. And so they drag themselves in, and they're typically quite resentful, but also worried, afraid to be judged, afraid to be condemned, not really trusting that they can get help from another person. They may look dismissive and devaluing of therapy, which is one of the challenges of working with people like this. But if you can look at these people, both the inhibited kind, the covert, as well as the overt, grandiose kind, is really coming from the same place, a kind of a wounded, hurt child who didn't get his or her needs met, then you can see the humanity in them and the neediness that they really feel.
So beyond building this close, trusted relationship, you know, what's on your agenda if you're working with somebody, say, with pathological narcissism, some form of pathological narcissism? What are you trying to do concretely? What are you trying to encourage this person to investigate such that change might be possible or more possible?
To very gently help them to see that there are other people in the world that have needs, wants, and desires like they do. To help them to see other people as a resource, not an impediment to getting what they want. So I don't know that I have concrete steps. When people come to my office and they say, what do I do? I say, let's talk about what's on your mind. It's, you know, the stereotype or the caricature has some validity to it. Those are about as concrete as the steps go. Come when you can, talk as honestly as you can, and then my job is to help show them in a way that they can tolerate how they're engaging and relating to me.
How important is the step of taking that person back to their childhood, having them talk about the way they were brought up, the feelings that they had as they were brought up, and trying to get them to understand perhaps what happened in their developmental process that might have steered them in a direction that's making them unhappy and maybe making people around them unhappy?
Well, these things obviously developed out of their childhood. We're all born narcissistic, and then something doesn't happen to change us. So we're going to hear the story of a person's childhood, and they're going to tell us about what they remember about the way that they were raised, how they were treated by their mother, father, caregivers in their life, if they were abandoned, or, you know, we're going to hear their life story. And we're going to hear the way that they bring that into the relationship that they have with the therapist or analyst. They're going to treat us often the way that they felt like they were treated. They're going to expect us to respond to them the way they were used to being responded to. And then as a psychoanalyst, what I do is interpret that and say, well, you know, this is how you're treating me. You sort of, I was asked a question in a meeting about this the other night. Somebody says, well, what do you do when the patient shows you contempt? And you say, well, I guess my answer was that most of the time they don't know they're showing contempt. So I'll just say, you know, every time I say something, you look at me like I'm an idiot. And then we can have a conversation about it, because I don't think people are that self-aware most of the time.
But my impression of the psychoanalyst is that, you know, he or she is quite impassive and doesn't really respond to the questions of the client or the patient, and, you know, maybe turns the question around to more fully flesh out, to have the client more fully flesh out what's going on in their lives or in their past lives.
Well, that's certainly the image that we got of the psychoanalyst from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And, you know, of course, cartoons in The New Yorker don't really have conversations. So I think that's mostly what we know, what people know about psychoanalysis. But over the last 30 years, another school of psychoanalytic thought has emerged, at least as it applies psychoanalysis to treating people, and it's called the relational school. And it really grew out of the developmental psychologists and psychoanalysts who looked at child development and could see the importance of a real relationship in a child's life. And that carries itself forward into the therapeutic work. I have people say to me, my last analyst was really quiet and didn't engage with me the way that you do. So I think that as a profession and a discipline, things are changing. That's different from giving advice. I still give very little advice. I'm not that smart, actually. People have heard, have been given good advice all their lives, and they've had lots of books that they could read. And if they could just take the advice that they were given, they probably wouldn't have needed to see a therapist or an analyst in the first place. So I think my job is to help people understand what makes it hard to accept advice and the knowledge that's out there, whether from me or anyone else.
Not smart, huh? Well, let me say, this very humble person is president of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. Michael Donner is an Oakland-based psychoanalyst and a clinical and forensic psychologist as well. And again, he teaches and consults on law and ethics for clinicians in California and across the country. Michael Donner, great meeting you, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, CS. I really enjoyed being here today.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.